It started out like any other night in the quiet town of Lake Park, Florida. Travis Rudolph was working his way back to the NFL after an injury put his career on pause and had spent the day training in Miami. That evening, he hung with a woman named Dominique, who he'd been dating for over a year. But what began as a peaceful evening devolved into a series of events that led to a bloody brawl between six men on the front lawn of Travis's house, and one person shot to death. 39 shots rang out that night, but the details of the shooting remain a mystery. Was it a shootout, an angry reaction, or a terrified response? Or worse? This is a story of how a once promising athlete found himself at the center of a fatal shooting, and how one night produced two completely different narratives. The prosecution says it was vengeance. The defense says it was survival. But it's the jurors who have the final say. I'm Brandi Churchwell, and this is 13th Juror. Today's episode is Florida versus Travis Rudolph, Part 1, The Prosecution's Case. Travis Rudolph was born to play football. A standout wide receiver from the beginning, he rose to national attention at Cardinal Newman High School in West Palm Beach, Florida, where he shattered school records and became one of the top high school recruits in the country. He took his talents to Florida State University, where he quickly became a star, leading the football team in receiving and breaking bowl records. After three successful seasons as a Seminole, Travis opted to forego his senior year and instead entered the 2017 NFL Draft. After a brief stint with the New York Giants, he signed with the Miami Dolphins. But an injury on the first day of practice brought his football career to an unexpected halt. By 2020, Travis was back in his hometown, recovering from surgery, focusing on rehab, and hoping to work his way back to the NFL. But one night in April of 2021, everything changed. Let's start with the undisputed facts. Travis Rudolph and Dominique Jones made plans to get together on the night of April 6th, 2021. They hung out at Travis's house and had a few drinks. At one point in the evening, Dominique went through Travis's phone and found text messages between him and another woman. This discovery led to a physical altercation between the couple. Eventually, Dominique left and called her brother, Keyshawn. Just around midnight, Keyshawn and three of his friends showed up at Travis's house and demanded to speak with him. Moments later, a fight broke out on the lawn. Travis went back into his house and returned with a semi-automatic rifle. 39 shots were fired, leaving one dead and another injured. Travis was arrested and charged with one count of first-degree murder and three counts of attempted murder. 2 years later, the trial of Travis Rudolph begins in Palm Beach County, Florida, and 12 strangers are chosen to hear two very different stories of what happened that night. Based on the testimony and the evidence they presented, this is the prosecution's version of the story. In his opening statements, prosecutor Richard Clossy read a quote, "Murder begins when self-defense ends." The prosecution's entire case rests on that theory, that the threat had ended, that four unarmed men were retreating, not attacking, and Travis Rudolph was angry, not in danger. But who did they call to the stand to prove this? Travis Rudolph met Dominique in early 2020, right around the time the world began to shut down. Dominique had just earned her real estate license, but when COVID hit and work dried up, the 23-year-old was suddenly out of a job and spending more time at Travis's. With everything closed and nowhere to be, Travis and Dominique got to know each other fast. According to Dominique's testimony, despite how often they were together, Travis told her early on that he wasn't ready for a committed relationship. But by the time her birthday came around in October, Dominique says their conversations started to shift, and they began talking about becoming more serious. However, the honeymoon phase didn't last long. In February of 2021, Dominique underwent plastic surgery. For the first week of her recovery, Travis was by her side, helping care for her when she couldn't do much for herself. But not long after, Dominique says something began to change. She felt a growing distance between her and Travis. They weren't seeing each other as often, and when they did talk, things just weren't clicking. They argued more. There was tension. Just after midnight on April 6th, the two decided to take a break. But after deciding on the break, they still made plans to meet up that afternoon and hang out, maybe see a movie together. It's around 5 p.m. when Dominique arrives at Travis's house. The movie that they're planning to see isn't for a few hours, so Travis and Dominique pick something up to drink from the liquor store and make a few drinks at home. Things feel normal. They're laughing, playing Uno, and enjoying each other's company. For a moment, Dominique feels like things might be getting back on track. That is, until she decides to look at Travis's phone while he's out of the room. That's when she finds text conversations between Travis and another woman. Immediately, Dominique is furious. She walks into the bedroom, grabs her things, and is getting ready to leave when, according to Dominique, Travis comes back inside and notices that she has gone through his phone. An argument ensues. Dominique testified that she threw his phone and possibly some other items, though she says she can't fully remember. She tells Travis she's leaving, but he's standing in the doorway blocking her exit. He tells her they need to talk. That's when, according to Dominique, she grabs one of Travis's trophies and threatens to hit him if he doesn't move. Travis eventually steps aside, and Dominique makes her way out. But the fight doesn't end there. Outside, Dominique says Travis becomes erratic. He's yelling, screaming in her face, and calling her names. DJ, Travis's brother, tries to intervene, telling Travis to calm down and just let her leave. Then, according to Dominique, Travis slams her to the ground right outside his home. That, she says, is the moment things turned. Up until then, she hadn't laid a hand on him. But after being thrown to the ground, just 2 months after cosmetic surgery, she snapped. Dominique admits she began hitting him in return, adrenaline running high from the altercation. Eventually, she leaves the house. Still shaken and angry, Dominique calls her brother, Keyshawn Jones, and tells him what had happened, and that Travis had just slammed her to the ground. She wants him to confront Travis and tells him to do so. According to Dominique, when she arrives at her mother's house, where she and her brother were living at the time, Keyshawn is home. The two talk, and although Keyshawn thinks Dominique and Travis are overreacting, he tells his sister he wants to go to Travis's house to talk to him about what had happened. And he does. But he doesn't go alone. Keyshawn brings along three other men. The group pulls up to Travis's home in the middle of the night. And by the time they leave, one of them is dead. It's after 9 p.m. when 21-year-old Keyshawn gets a text from his sister, Dominique, telling him that her boyfriend, Travis, had just slammed her to the ground. Keyshawn has met Travis before. They followed each other on social media and were friendly. So the text catches him off guard. He's angry, but mostly he's confused. In his testimony, Keyshawn says that he immediately tries calling both Dominique and Travis, but neither answer. He tries Travis again and again. He's not sure how many times, maybe four, maybe seven, and he leaves voicemails. He even texts him directly, trying to figure out what happened, and writes, quote, "On God, you're not that crazy," end quote. When Dominique gets home, she shows Keyshawn bruises that she says came from the fight. That's when Keyshawn decides to confront Travis with backup. No one is going to lay a finger on his sister without some consequences. Before heading to Travis's, he stops at the home of his lifelong friend, Tyler Robinson, who then reaches out to two of their closest friends, Chris Lowe, and Sebastian Jean-Jacques. Keyshawn later said he wanted backup, not because he expected violence, but because Travis had already been physical once, and he didn't know what to expect. He insists he didn't know Chris and Sebastian were coming. Tyler made the call. But once they all arrived at Tyler's just around midnight, the four men made their way to Travis's house. The four young men pull up just down the street from the Rudolph home and walk to the front door. Keyshawn says he made it clear they were just there to talk. When DJ, Travis's older brother, answers the door, the group asks to talk to Travis. Moments later, Travis appears, and according to Keyshawn, he's already angry. Voices are raised, yelling, cursing. Keyshawn says Travis was the one escalating and that he personally wasn't really engaging. Fighting's not his thing. Then, suddenly, Keyshawn says Travis picks him up and slams him to the ground. That's when all hell breaks loose. Tyler jumps in, then DJ, then Chris, then Sebastian. All six men, fist flying in a chaotic brawl on the front yard after midnight. Tyler and Keyshawn are fighting Travis, while Chris and Sebastian are fighting DJ. In both situations, it's two against one. At one point, according to Keyshawn's testimony, the fighting paused. Everyone is just standing there, out of breath, uncertain. Then, according to him, Travis suddenly punches Tyler, and it all explodes again. No one is sure how long the fight lasts. Maybe a few minutes, maybe more. Then Linda, Travis and DJ's mom, makes her way outside, trying to break things up. She's shouting, trying to calm everyone down, even holding up her phone to show ring camera footage. She kept pleading with them to watch it on her phone, but it's no use. No one will stop to look. The fight rages on. Things have gotten way out of control. So Keyshawn and Chris decide it's time to go. They tried to head toward the car down the street. That's when Travis breaks away from the group, runs inside his house, and comes back with a rifle. DJ was further down the road, still grappling with Sebastian. In Tyler's testimony, he says he saw Travis emerge from his house with the gun while he was still standing in the street. That's when Tyler says he realized the fight was over. You can even hear Tyler on the ring video yelling, "You got that." He says it was a form of surrendering. He put his hands up and told Travis, "You got that." Tyler realizes that since the others are further down the street, they likely don't know that a gun has been pulled out. He makes a quick break toward the car in an attempt to warn them and to escape impending gunfire as Travis loads his gun. As Tyler reaches the car, gunfire erupts. Tyler pushes Chris into the back seat and then dives in behind him and shuts the doors. Sebastian and Keyshawn are up front. Travis was now in the street firing at them with the rifle. Bullets strike the car and the car's windows all around them. According to Tyler, the car moves slower than he'd expect it to, and then it comes to a stop. It's at that moment, with bullets flying, the car not moving, and everyone silent, Tyler begins to think that everyone in the car is dead. Finally, after what was probably 10 seconds but feels like an eternity, the car begins to move, makes a right, and quickly speeds away. But two things are horribly wrong. Tyler isn't in the car, and Sebastian has been shot. Panic sets in. The group tries to locate the nearest hospital, but don't know the area. And they pass the nearest one without even realizing it. And as if things couldn't get worse, a bullet has damaged the oil reservoir, so the engine starts to fail. A surveillance camera in the area catches the men's car coming to a sputtering stop in what looks like an abandoned automotive shop toward the back of the parking lot. Then, at 12:18 a.m., 7 minutes after the shots were fired, Keyshawn makes a call to 911. He tells the dispatcher to send help. "Travis Rudolph shot at us. My friend's been hit, and he's not moving." Multiple police officers arrive on the scene. But since the automotive shop and the Rudolph home are in two different jurisdictions, the West Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department and West Palm Beach Police Department both become involved. Officers speak to Chris and Keyshawn, who said they had only gone to the house to talk, but were met with violence. They explain that Travis is the only one with a gun and that none of them were armed. But not everyone is accounted for when they stop at the auto shop. Where is Tyler Robinson? Well, in his testimony, Tyler says he was in the car at first. When the bullets started flying, he dives into the back seat and is laying on top of Chris. He can hear the bullets hitting the car around him when he feels a bullet hit him. Then, shortly after, another. It's at that moment when he thinks all his friends are dead. So he opens the car door and decides to make a run for it. He can hear bullets whizzing past his head, then feels a third bullet hit him in his lower abdominal or hip area. He makes it away from the Rudolph home, bleeding and alone, and realizes he's in pretty bad shape and should call for help. But there's another problem. His phone is still in Keyshawn's car. So he begins knocking on doors to no avail. Tyler is exhausted and losing strength when he hears sirens in the distance. He assumes the police have been called. He feels like he needs to rest, so he sits down outside a dark, empty house. He can feel himself dying and accepts that this is his fate. He thinks, these are the consequences of my actions. But then he hears the sound of rapidly approaching footsteps. He looks up to see a man running down the street toward him with a phone outstretched in his hand. The man says he heard everything and tells Tyler, "Don't worry, police are on the way." Dominique knows that her brother and his friends are going to Travis's house, but she hasn't heard from anyone since Tyler texted her, quote unquote, "I got you," just before midnight. She assumes they've talked things out with Travis and maybe have gone to meet up with some girls. But then she starts getting texts from DJ Rudolph. He keeps saying they're wrong for coming to his mom's house and trying to jump Travis. Dominique tells DJ to stop texting her. She doesn't know what he was talking about. Back at the auto shop, lead detective Emily Vanderlyn arrives about an hour after the 911 call comes in. She conducts brief interviews with Keyshawn and Chris, who give their accounts of what happened. According to them, a physical fight turned deadly when Travis Rudolph opened fire at the unarmed men. She doesn't search the Cadillac, but does notice a fluid leaking from underneath the vehicle and what appears to be bullet holes on the body of the car. Detective Vanderlyn receives no credible evidence that anyone other than Travis had fired a weapon. So she quickly determines, based on physical evidence and Chris and Keyshawn's statements, that there is probable cause to arrest Travis. She releases Keyshawn and Chris and heads toward the Rudolph home. Once the police release Keyshawn and Chris, they make their way to the hospital where Tyler has just been taken. When they arrive, he's in surgery because he was shot 3 times. In the back of his right shoulder, in his lower back on the right side, and his left hip in the lower abdominal area. It would be the next day before they could even see or talk to him. Keyshawn calls Dominique to tell her what had happened. Sebastian Jean-Jacques had been killed. Dominique joins her brother and his friends at the hospital. And just before 2:30 a.m., she sends another text to DJ Rudolph's phone saying, quote, "You're going to jail. You killed someone," end quote. When police arrive at the Rudolph home, they handcuff Travis and begin searching and processing the scene. Detective Vanderlyn attempts to talk to Linda and DJ, but they won't speak to her without an attorney. So she gives them her card. A crime scene investigator processes the surrounding area and finds 39 spent shell casings scattered around the street outside the home. Police also collect several guns and ammunition from the home, along with the family's video surveillance system and Travis's phone. The firearm Travis used had been put back in his closet, and the drum was placed under DJ's bed, with the remaining 61 cartridges still inside. A ballistics analysis confirmed that 38 of 39 rounds were fired from Travis's Sig Sauer 223 semi-automatic rifle, fitted with the 100-round drum magazine. When police recovered the gun and drum, the magazine still contained the 61 remaining rounds. Police collect video footage from neighbors and are able to see the Cadillac pulling up toward the Rudolph home. Keyshawn, Tyler, Chris, and Sebastian are seen stopping a couple blocks away, putting some items in the trunk, and then continuing forward, pulling closer to the home, parking about a block away. Police are also able to collect video footage from a neighbor that shows the flash of the muzzle when the shots are fired, along with grainy footage of the men on the street. The following day, Detective Vanderlyn goes to the home of Tyler Robinson, who has now been released from the hospital. Tyler gives the same story that Keyshawn and Chris did, pointing to Travis as the aggressor, as they were trying to flee. Sebastian Jean-Jacques' autopsy reveals he was shot 10 times. According to the medical examiner, the bullets entered predominantly either right to left or back to front, a trajectory that's consistent with Sebastian being seated in the front passenger seat of the Cadillac, which was facing the Rudolph home before it drove away. To the prosecution, this detail is damning. They argue that if Travis truly feared for his life, why did he shoot a man in the back, in a moving car, as they were trying to drive away? As the prosecution laid out their version of events, the courtroom was hit with a series of powerful moments, including the reveal of a witness who claimed to have seen everything. This wasn't just another piece of evidence. It was a potential game changer, a firsthand account of what happened in those critical moments right before the shots were fired. Enter Mr. Estes, the Rudolph's neighbor. Mr. Estes is very familiar with the Rudolph family. He knows Travis, but he's closer to DJ. He's also done some handiwork for Linda, and in turn, Linda sometimes cooks supper for him as a thank you. Mr. Estes witnessed the argument between Travis and Dominique. When he heard yelling, he walked to the window to see what the commotion was and watched as Travis and Dominique's argument turned physical. A couple hours later, there seemed to be another disturbance in his normally quiet neighborhood. But this time, it wasn't a lover's quarrel. This seemed more serious. Although it was dark, Mr. Estes said he could see the brawl from his window. He described it as two piles of people yelling and fighting. It was enough to make him nervous, so he walked to the back of the house to get his gun, just in case. And when he came back and looked out again, he saw the flash of a muzzle and heard shots being fired. The gunshots stopped for just a moment and then erupt again shortly after. Then they stopped for good. He expected to see police pull up any minute, but they didn't. That's when he called 911 to report what he had just seen. Another impactful courtroom moment came with the introduction of the Shot Spotter, a gunshot detection technology system used by law enforcement to identify and locate gunfire in real time. It works by using a network of acoustic sensors placed throughout an area to detect the sound of gunfire. Once a possible gunshot is detected, the system analyzes the sound, filters out other noises like fireworks or car backfires, and triangulates the precise location of the shots. Within seconds, an alert is sent to police with details on the number of rounds fired and their location. ShotSpotter played a key role in backing up parts of the prosecution's story. According to the data they collected, 39 shots were fired from outside Travis's home, right down the block by where the Cadillac was parked, and they all came from one direction, Travis's. The prosecution argued that this supports their story that the shots were excessive and deliberate, not part of a chaotic shootout. The system recorded audio of the shots, and that audio was played in court for the jury. They listened to the sound of 30-plus rounds being fired in succession. Once testimony is complete and all evidence has been presented, a prosecution must present their closing arguments. This is their final chance to address the jury, summarize their case, and show how they've met their burden of proof. The prosecutors in this case acknowledged that Travis had a right to be upset that those four men showed up to his home in the middle of the night, and they also admitted the men didn't show up with a fair fight in mind, but they argued that this isn't why the jury was summoned to court. They claimed this didn't start with the men pulling up to Travis's home. This started with the 39 bullets. Prosecutor Francine Edwards began listing out the damage to the Cadillac, one by one, giving the location of every bullet hole. There are some in the front of the car and the windshield, the driver's side door and window, front and rear passenger doors and windows, the fenders, and the car pillars. In total, there are 30 gunshot defects to the car. And Edwards told the jury that as a result of those gunshots, Sebastian Jean-Jacques is dead. Edwards also explained the law to the jury, letting them know what is considered justifiable deadly force in the state of Florida. In order for this to be considered self-defense, Travis had to have believed that the force he used was necessary to protect himself or DJ. The circumstances of the situation must be taken into account. And the jury has to determine that not only Travis, but any reasonable person would have felt the same way. Edwards argued that Travis pursued the men, which would negate the self-defense claim. She explained that a person can't pursue someone and then claim self-defense. The prosecution painted a picture of four men who intended to confront, not kill, Travis Rudolph. Maybe a fight, maybe a scare, but not a shootout. For the prosecution, this case is not about who threw the first punch or even who fired the shots. It's not about whether emotions ran high or if mistakes were made. It's all about what happened after the threat was over. According to the prosecution, Travis Rudolph, a man trained in discipline and control, chose violence when the fight was already over. Instead of closing the door, he opened fire. Instead of getting to safety, he grabbed a rifle and fired 39 rounds down a quiet neighborhood street. The prosecution says that those final moments, based on witness testimony, forensic evidence, bullet paths, and camera footage, tell the story of a man who crossed a line from self-defense to retaliation. To them, it's not about standing your ground. It's about knowing when the danger ends and murder begins. The prosecution thought they had this case locked up tight. But remember, in every trial, there are two stories to be told. What if the four men weren't unarmed when they arrived at Travis's house? What if there was a deleted text message about plotting a shootout? When new evidence is brought forward, suddenly the narrative begins to shift. In the next episode, the defense takes the courtroom by storm, and everything you thought you knew gets put on trial. A loaded gun, a deleted message, and a medical examiner who drops a huge bombshell. Plus, Travis Rudolph takes the stand, defending not only his life, but his intentions. And what he has to say might just change everything. Because in the end, this case isn't just about how many bullets were fired. It's about why they were fired. It's about fear, perception, and that fine, irreversible line between self-defense and deadly force.